Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Thank you for joining us today for our podcast on firefighter health and safety and the codes process, sponsored by the National Fire Sprinkler Association. In recent months, the NFSA has sponsored a series of podcasts that have taken a look at America's fire problem and some of the solutions that are available to address the issue. We have heard from fire service leaders, including Chief Alan Brunicini, Chief Dennis Rubin, and others. We have heard from the Common Voices advocates, those who have been directly affected by fire. And today, we refocus on the fire service. It's time for the fire service to get involved. Today's podcast will focus on citizen and firefighter safety and our involvement or lack thereof in the codes-making process. We will examine current work in the codes arena, specifically proposals to include fire sprinkler requirements in the code. Let's join the podcast.
Hi, this is Shane Ray. Welcome to our podcast, Get Involved, Save Citizens and Firefighters' Lives. We'd like to welcome our panelists today. We have a fine list of panelists here. Chief Billy Goldfeder is with us. How are you doing, Chief?
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We have Mary Kay with the Home Safety Council.
Hi, Mary Kay. Hi there.
We have Jeff Shapiro, code consultant. Are you with us there, Jeff?
I'm here.
Great. Thanks for joining us. We'd like to talk about today with this podcast, we get involved. NFPA codes have required fire sprinklers in one- and two-family dwellings, and they provide strong retrofit guidance in high-hazard occupancies. However, not many jurisdictions have adopted these requirements, which is probably our fault as a fire service. But now we have the opportunity to require fire sprinklers in one- and two-family dwellings in the international building codes, particularly the international residential code. The fire service has been involved not only to require this in the code adoption at the state and local level, but now's our opportunity again to go to Minneapolis where the code hearings are, since we weren't as successful as we'd like to have been in Rochester. Chief Brunicini was on a previous podcast that we had and said that we don't change our tactics because of how the building was built or maintained in accordance with the code. He also said that the building's going to live or die under the code in which it's built under. And if the code has a tactical significance to what we can do, well, the fire service hasn't changed our tactics like we should. So those are kind of where we'd like to go with this call, is the fact of how do we get the fire service involved in the codes process. And so we'll start with Jeff. Jeff, you've been working on this for years. Why should the traditional fire service, operations fire service people be involved in this codes process?
Well, and the short answer is that their life may depend on it. When I worked in the fire marshal's office for many years training firefighters, and as a firefighter before that, I recognized the difficulty in getting people who are focused on a suppression mentality involved in fire codes and fire prevention. But one piece that I often registered with when I would do classes for people out in the field is when you participate in fire prevention, the inspection that you do and the problem that you may find could very much save your life if the building catches on fire. If the building is designed with a fire sprinkler system, chances are that the designer took the incentive package that was offered in the code to reduce some other aspects of construction based on the installation of sprinklers. So you need to make sure the sprinklers work because the building's survival and your survival depends on that. Same approach really applies in codes as well. The difficulty we face for many years in the code arena was that the people who are writing codes are architects and engineers and people in industry who are changing the code, adding or deleting, but they don't understand the impact necessarily of what they're doing on somebody who has to go into that building when it burns. And it's really been great to have the fire service become involved. Sean DeCrane and the IAFF and the IFC's Fire and Life Safety Section and others, their participation in the code process has been hugely beneficial to give that perspective of what happens when the building catches on fire and what does the fire department have to do. So I think it's very important for them to be involved. It's easy for them to be involved. The ICC encourages the fire service to be involved. And it's been great to see that beginning to happen.
Great. Did I skip over Chief Sean DeCrane? Sean, are you on the podcast with us?
I am here, Shane.
Awesome. Well, sorry to skip you there, buddy.
No, it's okay.
I was searching for your phone number a few minutes before this, so I must have missed you in my technical difficulties. But thanks for being here. Do you want to expand on what Jeff's saying there? I know you all are fixing to have your annual conference.
I agree with what Jeff just said. It's, you know, as a fire service, one of the things we're trying to get across to our members is that they need to be involved in their work environment. And our stations are only our staging grounds. Our work environment is actually the built environment that's out there. And we need to be involved at the ground level where the approvals for how these buildings will be constructed are discussed and decided upon. So we can put our input in. People don't have a chance to see how a building reacts to fire like our members do. They're inside of it. They see it directly, and they're the ones that can, you know, tell their story. They don't have to get into technical discussions, but they can tell their story of how a building performed or a system performed or problems with it, and that's what we're trying to encourage our members to do.
Well, and that's where we get to, Chief Goldfeder, you're, I look at you as a spokesperson for the American Fire Service. You give us all the information on the casualties that we have out there, if you will, the recent line of duty death in Illinois where a firefighter fell through the floor. When will we get it, and what do we need to do to advance this cause?
Well, I'm only a spokesman, a spokesperson for the fire service that agrees with me, so keep that in mind. We are starting to get it. You know, people say, oh, more line of duty deaths and more of this and more of that. And it's going to be tough to impact the number of line of duty deaths we have. It's going to be easier to impact the injuries. And once we impact the injuries, then the deaths will take care of themselves. And, I mean, forgetting the heart and stroke issue, which we understand is both a personal as well as an operational issue from a fire department standpoint, then we get into the vehicular accident situations, and that's very manageable. When we're ready to deal with the vehicular accident situation, we'll be able to. So that leaves us with structural firefighting. And I think that the firefighter today is, and I have to speak generally because I can certainly bring you many examples. Unfortunately, it's the improperly staffed or uneducated departments. And I don't mean that as a slam. I mean that as that they're just not keeping up with what current training is. And current technology as far as going into some of these buildings. And quite frankly, as a part of your size up, when you get to the fire, not only do you have to determine where's the fire, where was it, you know, where's it going, what's the construction, and all the other things that we have to do for our size up, we also then have to determine whether or not we have the resources on the scene to deal with what we just sized up. And when you arrive on a scene with three or four people and an engine company, and there's no other companies on the way, or it's going to be a while until they get there, and you've got a fire in front of you that's going to require the services of 25 to 30 firefighters, you cannot do what you want to do. No matter how good you want to be, no matter how dedicated you are, it ain't going to happen. And it's predictable what's going to go wrong. So amongst that, and that ties into the changing of our tactics, and I think we are starting to see that not only from the construction standpoint, but from the economic standpoint. More and more union leaders, more and more fire chiefs are telling their cities, if you're going to cut back, this is going to be the impact of the cuts. Now, there's still chiefs and other areas that are not courageous enough to let their community know the facts. But for the most part, chiefs and union leaders are getting out there, and volunteer leaders as well, I'm sure in some areas of volunteer companies where they're cutting funding too, are telling the community, that we simply can't do what the storybooks show you, what the movies show you, because we don't have the resources. Now, what I've talked about in just the last couple minutes is the problem. A way to make most of this go away is sprinkler systems. And that's kind of, I think, where you're at with this today, Shane, and the rest of us, is if we can get this passed so the code can change and we can have residential sprinklers mandatory, much of the problem will take care of itself. And unfortunately, what we're up against is groups like the National Association of Home Builders and the local home builder associations, which are pumping loads of dollars into this effort to try and fight what we're trying to get done. So I'll pause for a minute and see if that's kind of what you were looking for, Shane.
Yeah, no, that's how we in Pleasant View is. We require all new construction here to be sprinklered. It's the fact that we can't properly staff by any code or standard that deals with the deployment of the fire service. So as I sit here and look at these NOSH line of duty deaths, it says career firefighter dies in residential structure fire. Volunteer firefighter dies after falling through the floor supported by engineered wood truss. Volunteer deputy chief dies after falling through the floor. Career firefighter dies while exiting residential fire. I look at all these line of duty deaths and say, if we're not doing a proper size up, if we're not doing some of these things and we can't change all that in the fire service, there's got to be a better way. And if we can do that when the codes are built, and a lot of these houses, they're new. This house built in 2004. This house built in 2004. This one, 99. We could have made a difference in those events, and I think that's where we have to get involved. And I hope you're right, Chief Goldfeder, that we are getting it.
Well, let me jump in, and again, I can't broad brush it because there's certainly examples you've given and I've mentioned as well, but we are. My son's a firefighter, and I talked to him just a few weeks ago and reminded him, because he goes on the roof and does the things that his truck company has to do. And a very simple over a drink, non-alcoholic, on my end anyway, while we were talking, I said, remember, when you go to the roof and something's on fire, the shed underneath is burning, and therefore what you're standing on is not going to be as stable. It's simple, simple stuff. And we're walking, we're going to houses with smoke showing, firefighters walking right in the front door, and boom, dropping into the basement. So that's the, and this is not, they don't need to go to a whole lot of training to understand some of this stuff. And the leadership as well, where's the leadership on this in educating the firefighters and training them? You know, that we just can't go in on above the floor in all cases. A lot of times, Shane, guys like you and me and others on this call grew up watching and listening to the backdraft movies and things like this as firefighters ran in. And it isn't always that way. Listen, Shane, I'm going to have to go. They just called me. For those listening, Shane can explain to you where I'm at. But I'm going to have to split. If I can call back, I will.
Great. Thanks, Chief Goldfeder.
Take care, everyone.
All right. Chief Goldfeder had to drop off there. He's in Florida with his mother, who is about to go in surgery. So I think that shows the dedication of that guy to this call. So, but speaking of what we've been talking about, Jeff, could you fill us in? I know Underwriters Laboratory for the last, since January of 08, have been working on some test burns that compared engineered wood products to conventional construction, sawn lumber, if you will, and Tyco products. Has also conducted some full-scale test burns at Underwriters Laboratory to go in conjunction with what the UL tests have been doing. Jeff, you want to share some of that information with us?
Yeah, well, UL received a grant to do some testing at Department of Homeland for the Department of Homeland Security related to lightweight construction, and then Tyco Fire and Building Products actually piggybacked on that and sponsored some separate tests, which involved fire sprinklers in the same space, and then a free burn at the end without the sprinklers. And you know, to the issue of is lightweight construction less safe, I think the answer is yes. To the issue of is wood construction and residential construction safe at all, I think the answer is no, and it's been that way for quite some time. Even with dimensional lumber, houses burn very quickly. But the problem, to some extent, as I see it, is with lightweight construction, the time to failure, as shown in these tests, tends to be just about the time that the fire department is arriving on the scene and beginning to operate. And that little bit of extra time that you may have gotten out of dimensional lumber could make the difference between going through the door and going through the floor, or going through the door and have some minimal amount of time where you can operate and get out. I mean, as I said, residential construction was never safe, but lightweight residential construction was shown by these tests to be unsafe at the time that firefighters are arriving. Out of these tests, there were also some sprinkler tests, as I mentioned, that were done. And in one of the cases, as a demonstration, there was a single sprinkler exposed piping underneath wood construction, lightweight construction, in a 16 by 16 room, and the single sprinkler activated quickly and actually extinguished the fire. We are in the process of working at breakneck pace to do a video of that, which will run about 5 to 6 minutes. It's in production right now at the same studio that does Fire and Emergency Television Network, who also did the webcast that we broadcast last year. And that's moving forward very quickly. The script is done. We're editing the video presently, and we hope to have that actually up and available for viewing on our website by next Friday, which would be not this coming Friday, the following Friday. And then we'll have that available for distribution as well. But those tests, and particularly the free burn, where we had firefighter mannequins on the roof of the structure, which was simulating a first floor over top of a basement. And it's even though you know you've seen it, and it shouldn't surprise you, it does. When you see the order of magnitude of fire, and the collapse of that assembly and the firefighter mannequins that were actually attached to aircraft cables and supposedly going to be pulled out, but in fact the cables failed and even the mannequins went in due to the amount of fire exposure. It's just, I mean, when you watch it, it's pretty incredible. I think people are going to be really interested in seeing this video, which clearly gives a demonstration that today's fire environment is certainly no better, and many people argue it's much worse than what we had in the past.
Yeah, in those tests, I was fortunate to witness the sprinkler test under the exposed I-joist, and it was to see that sprinkler operate, and the outcome was what we expected. But again, just like you said, even with the free burn, you watch it, and you're even when it occurs, you're like, wow. And so there is an alternative. And Sean, back to you with the fact that how do we get this message out that says, hey, here we've seen some failure, and we know this as firefighters, and as Jeff said, we've seen some of this before, but it's still shocking when you read these line of duty deaths. How do we get the message out?
Well, I'm sorry about that. There are a number of avenues we can take, and I know Fire Engineering and Firehouse and other publications are trying to get the message out. And at the upcoming IFF convention, we have a couple resolutions in strictly to deal with getting the message out to the fire service about the importance of the building codes, the importance of residential sprinklers, the importance of adhering to industry standards, and to get that to the leaders of the local leaders of the IFF to take that message back to their members. One of the statistics that we've been throwing out there a lot, and Jeff referred to it, that the fire ground's becoming more dangerous to the firefighter. We can go on and start talking about this will reduce, you know, residential sprinklers will reduce cardiac incidents because not so much stress will be put on our members at a fire. You know, if you can limit the size of the fire and contain it to one room, the stress level, the physical stresses you're putting on your individuals will be reduced. But in the 1970s, according to NFPA, 1.8 firefighters died from traumatic injuries per 100,000 structure fires. By the 1990s, that number went to 3 firefighters from the same traumatic injuries to 100,000 structure fires. So we've almost doubled the number of incidents of firefighters dying from traumatic injury. Now, we can look at our turnout gear as allowing us to go places that we should not be in, and that is true. But also, I believe the type of construction that we are facing now is giving our members a false sense of security. We are operating as we did in homes that were built 70, 80 years ago, and they're just not built to those standards. You can even look at the quality of wood. It has changed over the last 40 years.
Sure. And the most recent line of duty death that firefighters crawled in and through the floor. While that house was built in 1920. So that wasn't a lightweight construction issue, but it was, again, another one of those, the failure of the building and our members not realizing, hey, here's the impact of fire. The other thing that the UL smoke characterization study showed was the amount of energy released in a fire with today's contents, regardless
right.
of when the building was built.
Well, we have more and more products that are built with petroleum-based. Look at the plastics. Look at any, you know, the cable that we use in our homes now. All that stuff generates more heat. They're burning quicker. They're burning hotter. And our members are paying the price.
Well, Mary Kay, we've talked a lot about firefighter safety and a lot of focus on the firefighter, and that's kind of where we get to and what we get wrapped up in sometimes. But what about the person we're sworn to protect here, the most important person, I say, the good citizen?
Well, we all know, Shane, that fire, there is nothing better than a fire sprinkler in protecting people from a fire. And as somebody who's spent my entire career trying to help people understand the danger of fire, how to prevent it in the first place, and what to do if you have one, I am a huge fan, I think, as everybody knows, about fire sprinklers. In fact, my first job in this field, going back, I hate to admit it, like 25 years ago, was for Factory Mutual Engineering at a time when the industrial sprinkler head was being adapted for use in homes. And my job was actually to give tours of the full-scale fire test center where all these tests were being conducted so that we in the field and the insurance agents and everybody could understand the benefits of applying this technology to the home environment. So in a way, my whole career is flashing before my eyes as we prepare for this moment in Minneapolis, which I see as a very historic moment. I think this is going to be the moment that all of us who care about fire safety should stand up and be counted and be there, as I will be. And the more uniformed firefighters we can get in Minneapolis to send an unequivocal message that we feel this needs to be codified in the IRC, the better. So I just feel that this is our moment to stand up for the safety of the people we're sworn to serve, as well as the safety of those who put their lives on the line protecting us.
Yes, thank you. And you testified at the IRC hearings in Rochester, Mary Kay. So tell us what the Home Safety Council has to offer the firefighters and the citizens, because like, as a member of the expert network, I get this information, and so we need firefighters involved in that, as well as the MySafeHome.org, those things that the Home Safety Council is doing that ought to be in every firehouse in America.
Oh, boy, what a great question. The Home Safety Council really believes, as many listening to this podcast I'm sure do as well, that the best situation is to have a system in place to protect people from fire. And it starts with prevention. So the more we all can be doing to help people understand that the choices they make in their own homes can be pivotally important in terms of protecting their loved ones, that's a part of the job. And then moving through to make sure that the early warning is in place so that if there is a fire, people know about it at the earliest moment and get to safety. But as I was saying before, there's really nothing better than having, you know, water to put on that fire at the earliest possible moment. Any firefighter understands that as well. And when we can have it automatically available through a home fire sprinkler system, that's just the ideal. And it's what we all deserve in terms of fire safety. So those listening on the line, I hope will go to the Home Safety Council's web. We have two websites, homesafetycouncil.org, and then a brand new one that was thankfully sponsored by the National Fire Sprinkler Association, and it's called mysafehome.org. It's a virtual home online available free of charge to anybody, and you can go room by room through mysafehome.org and be shown the risks in each of the rooms and what can be done to keep it safer. And mysafehome.org features a 13D sprinkler system. Our goal is to try to help consumers understand the benefits of a home fire sprinkler system so that we can kind of get ahead of this curve and create more consumer demand. But the more we all back each other up, as I say, the better. And I'm hoping that people listening to this podcast will not only be using the Home Safety Council's wonderful resources, but the Home Fire Sprinkler Coalition, on which I also serve on the steering committee, has fabulous tools available to help our fire and life safety educators and other members of the fire service get in front of decision makers in the community to help promote these messages.
Thank you, Mary Kay. And we've got to engage in those levels. As I look at a new NFPA report out, the Characteristics of Home Fire Victims fact sheet here, it talks about something that we all already are very familiar with, and the fact that the very old and the very young are at the highest risk of death from fire. And it talks about specifically the race and gender, and it gives some great information, but it also talks about the fact that older adults over the age of 65, the fire fatalities have increased from 19% to 28%. Well, if we have the issue that says that the baby boomers are reaching retirement age and the population getting older is higher now than it's ever been, does that come back to say that fire deaths are going to continue to increase if we don't do something about that complete package in the codes process for all these new homes we're building?
Well, that's what the Home Safety Council definitely believes. It's a tsunami, and we know it's coming, and we have to act now because it is not going to get any better. And when we think about the reality of aging, or really anyone with any kind of a disability that would slow them down, we talked earlier about the contents of homes being much faster burning. I mean, it's like everything stacked against people to get out. So either we have to make sure the fire does not happen, or we better make sure our environments are sprinklered, because the middle ground there is not a pretty sight.
Yeah. And Jeff, what else in the codes process has taken us to remedy this problem? I know we've made a lot of progress, and I guess I'd ask you to share your experience on where we go from here in all those cases in the codes process.
One thing that's really nice to see is the precedent that was set on multifamily occupancies several years ago in the code. There was a partnership between the major multifamily builders and the fire service to come to an agreement where the code changed to require all multifamily occupancies to be equipped with fire sprinklers. And the only major opposition to that at the time was the National Association of Home Builders and the hotel and motel industry. The major multifamily builders that are represented by the National Multi-Housing Council agreed that they wanted to put sprinklers in multifamily occupancies, and they wanted a reasonable incentive package in the construction to help offset that cost and provide a fire safety package. But the result was a more or less cooperative agreement to change the code to get those fire sprinklers. And the Fire Sprinkler Coalition, the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition, which I'm representing this year in Minnesota, has tried to take the same approach with NAHB to find ways to incentivize the use of sprinklers in homes through various construction incentives and encouraging the use of infrastructure incentives, trying to simplify fire sprinkler design to be more of a cookbook approach. And we very much want to work in the direction of making fire sprinklers a standard feature in new home construction, because people who are buying or who are renting condos, apartments, et cetera, today that are built with fire sprinklers, when it comes time for them to go buy a home, aren't they going to expect fire sprinklers in the home if they came from hotels, motels, apartments that are all fire sprinkler? People who become home buyers typically go through the multifamily industry first, living in an apartment. If they've had a sprinklered apartment, you would certainly expect that when they go buy a home, they're going to want sprinklers in their homes. So But the one issue which Mary Kay might even comment on is the question of consumer knowledge and consumer demand. The home builders argue that there isn't any, and all of the surveys that I've seen argue quite the contrary, that the level of consumer knowledge and consumer demand has never been better, and it's surprisingly good. You know, homeowners, home buyers get that fire sprinklers are available, and in large numbers want them.
That's absolutely true, and the Home Fire Sprinkler Coalition has actually done surveys over the years. I can remember, and several on this call may remember it too, going to some of the home builder conferences and just practically being spit on there, and that even that's changing. There are individual home builders who are very pro sprinklers. So the organized opposition is something we have to be strategic about, but consumers more and more can be made to understand what a home fire sprinkler system will do for them. What we obviously don't need is, once you get somebody interested, having them get misinformation either from their realtor or their builder or even others in the community who say things that just aren't true. So we have a big job ahead of us, but it's one of the reasons why I think we have to really show a united front here. Those within the family have to stand up and really go shoulder to shoulder, because there are plenty of folks outside the camp who would like to do all kinds of mischief on this topic.
And that's where maybe we need to go from here, is that, Jeff, I know that the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition has in proposals, and that's what we need, the fire service listening to this, to engage not only themselves but their friends and neighbors to come and join us in Minneapolis. And I know Sean has been a true partner in this, and the IFF has a resolution supporting it. And been strong advocates, and Sean and the IFF as well have their own proposal for code changes. So if we could talk about that for a second, and what do we do when we get to Minneapolis? We go, and how do we get there? And Jeff, if you could share that with us.
Yeah, the hearing for Minneapolis, the schedule has actually been pretty closely set. There's a series of hearings in Minneapolis. It starts with ICC's annual business meeting from the 14th to the 17th, and then 17th to the 22nd of September is actually a series of code hearings, and it'll begin with the fire code and then the building code and eventually gets to the residential code. The schedule's been published so that we know for sure that the residential code cannot start before Saturday, the 20th at 6 p.m. And we unfortunately don't know whether it will start right at that point, or if they're behind on previous hearings, that pushes the time to start back. So what we're advising people is to arrive on Saturday afternoon, sometime before 5 o'clock, and then for sure they can be present for the IRC hearing when it begins, and staying until Monday about midday after, say, 1 o'clock. Most likely the vote will be on Sunday, but you wouldn't want to miss it by planning to just be there Sunday. It's better to come Saturday to Monday. We, the Fire Sprinkler Coalition, have raised funds to assist people who are interested in going and might not otherwise be able to afford to go. And you can apply for that travel assistance at www.ircfiresprinkler.org. Lots of people have been taking advantage of that program. But because of the procedural requirement in ICC for a final action vote of this nature, we require a two-thirds majority in order to prevail. So for every one individual that shows up to vote against sprinklers, it takes three people to vote for to actually achieve that two-thirds majority. And for that reason, for those people who we've come across that aren't in favor of mandating sprinklers in the residential code, we try to tell those folks, look, at least don't vote against, because then you don't count basically as a three vote against us, that we have to have all those other folks come in to change essentially that one that one vote, to offset that one vote. So we need the fire service to do a couple of things. We need the fire service to make the commitment to show up. There's over a million firefighters in the United States. We need a very, very small percentage of those folks to show up in Minnesota and change the future of residential fire safety in America. And even if you can't show up, still go talk to your local building official. And even if you can't convince them to vote for sprinklers if they're gone, just convince them not to vote. You know, if they don't have a position, then just not vote, because that'll make a huge difference in the final vote count if people who would have voted against us just decide to not vote at all.
Yes, and that's one of the things that we need to discuss is that building official, that partnership. As Sean said early, we have the issue that nobody knows the building, and as I say, there's nobody that's more responsible for the building. Once the building is built, in many cases, the building official, his time with that building is over. But the fire service continues responsibility for that building as long as it stands there and as long as there's a fire service. How do we engage those building officials to understand that issue, or how do we better partner with them to cooperate that the building is our responsibility after the fact, so we should have some input on the front end?
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Shane, did you want to talk a little bit about the Fire Team USA and the opportunity to kind of educate people in context?
Well, thank you, Mary Kay. That's Fire Team USA is trying to bring those people together, the fire chief, the fire marshal, the building official, and the mayor or city manager or the policymaker, the ones that make decisions for community fire protection. And that's been very successful. And with Jeff and Marshall Klein's help and some of those, we have spoke to a lot of building officials within the last few months in reference to the codes process, the votes, and what it means to community fire protection. So, yes, Fire Team USA is doing a great job out there trying to bring those people together.
I think the answer to your question, Shane, in terms of speaking to these individuals and understanding their perspective, many building officials come out of the building industry. In small communities, building officials often come out of the industry of being a home builder. And they interface with home builders on a regular basis, and they receive information from home builders on a regular basis. So, they're in communication. Building officials are typically in communication much more often with home builders and people who are involved in the construction industry than they are in the fire service. And that's a problem we need to fix. The other aspect of that we need to fix, which relates to it, is that I think a lot of building officials regard the builder, the home builder, as their customer, because that's the individual that they interface with. And in fact, what's not happening, what should happen, is that the building official should recognize that the consumer, the person who owns that customer, and that's the person we're trying to serve, and the best the consumers in their homes is to provide fire sprinklers.
I think Jeff hit a good spot there about the building official. The building officials are good people. They're trying to do their job, and they're trying to do a good job. But their offices are also at City Hall, where there are economic pressures, especially in a down economy. The pressures are there to create economic stimulus and to allow businesses to come in or builders to come in and maybe, I'm not saying break the rules, but give them a more friendly environment in that community so they will invest in it. And the fire service tends to be in a separate building, and we're trained and we take an oath to prevent loss of life and property. And that's what guides our beliefs and our actions, and we need to bridge that gap. I don't want it to be a building officials versus fire service, because in the end game, we are for the same thing. We're for the safety of the citizens. And maybe some building officials don't understand the impact of why we feel that this is such a needed requirement and how it can impact the safety of civilians.
I totally agree, and I think that telling the whole story, today's fire representatives really need to understand every aspect of safety And so that means really getting it down how you talk about preventing fires in the first place and, you know, helping to educate people to know how to help themselves so that by the time the fire department is on the scene, you know, they're meeting the family at the outside meeting place and not having to go searching through the building to find them. And then being really comfortable about new technologies. It isn't even that new. I mean, fire sprinklers have been around for over 100 years and last couple of decades available for homes. So, you know, it's just so important that we all kind of learn to speak each other's language and back each other up, because that's the team that will put us over in Minneapolis and going forwards.
Now, Shane, to that end, you know, one of the things that I find very gratifying, if you look at the organizations that have signed the resolution in support of the sprinkler requirement in the IRC, we've got three building official organizations from New Hampshire and Maryland and New York. And, in fact, New York building officials, NISBOC, was the first organization to sign the sprinkler support resolution that we came up with, which is now over 100 organizations that have signed that regionally, internationally, nationally. But we are seeing what I would consider to be a very good level of support starting to come out of the building official arena as we've invested time and effort in doing education programs to overcome the myths and misinformation and help the building officials understand the importance of this. And one of the tools that we've produced in that regard, actually there's two, the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition has a video that runs about an hour and a half that addresses many, many issues related to residential sprinklers and the questions that building officials might have. And then there is an abbreviated version that is directed specifically to building officials and policymakers that runs about 15 minutes that was recently done by the Home Fire Sprinkler Coalition. And you know, both of those DVDs are available at no charge. The Fire Sprinkler Coalition's HFSC's is on their website at homefiresprinkler.org, and ours is on our website at ircfiresprinkler.org.
Yes, and there is a lot of great information and a lot of great tools out there, more than I've ever seen in my career in the fire service, available to us to make these educated decisions and improve life safety in our community. As we get ready to close this up, I'd like to just open it up and say, let's go to Minneapolis and we'll see each other there, but I'd like to, for each one of you to close out and share your thoughts on the process and where we go from here.
Well, I'll start it. I'm Mary Kay, and the Home Safety Council is actually honored to be heading off to Minneapolis and you know, standing with our team up there. I'm actually predicting a positive outcome, but I'm taking nothing for granted, and I think it is so crucial that we have a really good turnout from the fire service. This is a time to really show the power of the American Fire Service to get this done, and we'll be among you and proudly casting our lot with yours, because it's that important to the safety of the American public.
I agree, Mary Kay. And as a fire service, we need to remember our oath. We take an oath to protect life and property and participate in any ways that we can do that. And also as a fire service, we need to realize that we can sit around the kitchen table and complain about the type of construction that's going on, or we can get involved and change it ourselves. For a relatively small investment, travel cost, we can be participating in these discussions at the codes that will ensure the safety of the public and the safety of our members. And so, you know, for that small investment, travel there. Go. Get in the debate. Let your voice be heard. And for, you know, most importantly, vote. And that's what I would encourage the fire service to do.
Yeah, and you've been doing that, Sean, as a representative there. As we've informed our policymakers here, our city officials, that it is a small investment, and it's something that's going to affect the entire community. Whether you have the latest codes adopted today or whether they're going to be adopted a few years from now, at one point these codes that we're up here debating and discussing and going through a great process to make changes to, they are going to affect each one of our communities. So I think you're exactly right with that, that it's very important that that travel cost is very justifiable when you can say that it affects the entire community.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that, you know, in my experience in being involved in codes and standards over more than 20 years, this is, in my opinion, the single biggest code issue that has come across the model code industry in terms of the level of support and opposition. It's clearly the most battled code issue that I've seen in history, and it's the most important issue, in my opinion, to codes in terms of overall life safety and the impact on fire losses since the codes required smoke alarms. It's time to take the next step, and the fire service, building officials, and many other folks have been getting behind this in good numbers to show their support and say they're going to go to Minnesota, and I would say it's unprecedented, the level of support that we're seeing, but it's not enough. And to the people that are listening to this podcast, if you aren't going, you need to go. You need to take responsibility if you can be a voting governmental member of ICC, to join and attend, and if you're attending, your jurisdiction gets at least three other votes. Depending on the size of the jurisdiction, you get 4, 8, or 12 votes with an ICC membership, and you need to bring some other folks with you as well. And as I said before, we have travel assistance funding available from the Fire Sprinkler Coalition. If you can't otherwise get there because you don't have the money, go on our website and fill out the application for travel assistance. We still have some available.
Yes, and Jeff, that's important. And when you say that this is the biggest vote probably in history of codes as far as fire and life safety goes, but also, too, there's a lot of other votes that go on that are important that all these groups have been influencing that in the few years that I've been involved in the process. I'd like to say it's very impressive to see that you deal with fire flow requirements, fire department access requirements. So there's all kinds of reasons why the fire service should be involved and not only get involved this time, but stay involved. And I think that's the theme of our podcast here is get involved, make a difference, because it does make a difference. And those are places, when you talk about code enforcement, we see a difference in our community here every day in issues that involve codes. And it does make a difference to life safety for citizens and firefighters. Well, I appreciate everybody joining us for the call. Special thanks to Firehouse.com for allowing us to do this podcast and to the National Fire Sprinkler Association for their sponsorship on these informative sessions. It's time. The message and the theme is from the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition is that it's time. It's time for the fire service to take action and make a difference in our community and our nation. And we will see everyone in Minneapolis.
Today's podcast was brought to you by the National Fire Sprinkler Association. For more information on the NFSA, please visit their website at www.nfsa.org. The panelists on today's podcast have offered solid options for proactive leadership from the fire service. It's time for us to get involved, and we hope to see you in upcoming months at fire service leadership conferences and code hearings. It's time for the fire service to speak to this important issue and educate others regarding proactive choices that can save both firefighter and citizen lives. It's time for fire sprinklers. Thank you for joining us today.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.